The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Morris Williams, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Free Library of Philadelphia to, again, a wonderful conversation about great ideas. Please allow me to add a few comments about our guests that are in addition to what you have in your program. Both of them were involved in corporate law firms before they became professors at Yale. I regret to say that they didn't stay at Duke University, which is my alma mater, where Dr. Chihua received tenure, but Yale and the distant commute caused her to join her husband at Yale. Both of them have won teaching awards, and I think you'll see evidence of their excellent presentations. Dr. Chihua is a double Harvard undergrad and law school, and Dr. Rubenfeld is a graduate of Princeton and Harvard Law School, where they met working on the law review. Both of them graduated with multiple honors from their schools. I think one of the things that's interesting about Dr. Rubenfeld is that he, between his graduation at Princeton, where he wrote his honors thesis on Freud, was accepted and studied at Juilliard in the drama division for several years before deciding to go to law school. The other interesting thing I think about Dr. Rubenfeld is that in 1989, while in corporate law, quote, he wrote an article for the Harvard Law Review, which is still talked about in legal circles today. It was what legal scholars call a brilliant argument about the right to privacy. In his article, he argues that privacy is inextricable from personhood and that the Constitution should guard a woman's right to choose an abortion because not allowing her to do so amounts to a kind of governmental control over a woman's identity. I hope that you will join me in buying multiple copies of the book and going upstairs to the book signing, which will follow their talk. But meanwhile, please join me in welcoming Amy Chihua and Jed Rubenfeld to a wonderful Philadelphia welcome.
Well, thank you, Morris, for that great introduction. What an honor for us it is to be at this this great library, and thank all of you for coming out this evening. I thought I should tell you a story of something that happened to Amy and me about 4 weeks ago. So we're in a coffee shop in New Haven, and we overhear a couple, and the woman is saying, did you hear about the two professors who have written a book saying that some races are superior to others? So aghast, we interrupted and demanded to know who the despicable professors were, to which she said, oh, it's the Tiger Mom, to which we were speechless, which she evidently misunderstood as our not knowing who the Tiger Mom was, because what she said was, oh, you know, it's that crazy Chinese woman and her white... So basically, that's how this odyssey of the last 4 weeks started, where we had to hear and keep hearing a book being described 3 weeks before it had been published by thousands of people who had never read it, described with a lot of names and a lot of insults. They were describing a book which we literally could not recognize as the book we had written. So it's a special pleasure for us to be here tonight to try to give you a sense of what we think our book is actually about, which is the rise and fall of groups. It's about three traits that we find are propelling individuals and groups to success, and about the very predictable way that those traits get eroded over time, in part because of success itself, and in part because of a kind of process of creative destruction that happens when those traits collide with American culture. Now, the starting point of our book is a fact. It's a remarkable fact, maybe an uncomfortable fact, which is that in this tough economy, some groups are just disproportionately outperforming the rest of the country. They're experiencing rates of exceptional upward mobility, unlike everybody else in the rest of the country. And it was our thought, Amy's and my thought, that, well, maybe we should try to get to the bottom of that and learn what the explanation was, because maybe it would be something that we could all learn from. That's really why we wrote the book. But let me give you a sense of the kind of facts I'm talking about, the sense of group differences. So just, and this is just, you know, scraping the tip of the iceberg, Indian Americans earn almost double the national figure. So their median household income is about $90,000 compared to about $50,000 for the rest of the country. Lebanese and Iranian Americans are not far behind in terms of income. Asian American kids score 140 points higher on their SATs on average than the rest of the country. Asian American college-age kids are about 5% of the college-age population in the United States. They're about 20% of the Ivy League student body now. And a lot of people think that number, that percentage, is artificially suppressed because of some anti-Asian bias in the Ivy Leagues. Here's something you probably didn't know. What do the CEOs and CFOs, recent or current, of the following companies have in common? American Express, Citigroup, JetBlue, Sears, Skullcandy, Dell, Fisher-Price. This list actually goes on Marriott, Huntsman. The answer is they're all Mormons. This is really quite surprising because just 30 years ago, it was very difficult to find a Mormon in a high place on Wall Street. I worked on Wall Street 30 years ago. I can attest to this, but many other people do too. It was hard to find Mormons in corporate boardrooms. And yet now they are experiencing extraordinary corporate success. Why is that? Another group whose success has been very well documented, and maybe in a way it's the most fraught, are Jewish Americans. Now, this has been talked about so much, I won't repeat it at all. I'll just mention two little facts. At less than 2% of the U.S. adult population, Jewish Americans have won more than a third of America's Nobel Prizes, and at this moment, they constitute a third of the seats on the United States Supreme Court. Now, there are many, many groups that we could have talked about. There are literally dozens of groups outperforming the national average. We only had a book of a couple hundred pages to write, plus the 100 pages of endnotes, so we couldn't talk about all of them. We focus on about eight groups, but there are really many, many other such groups, too. Now, it's uncomfortable to talk about this, or so it seems. A lot of people, you know, react with an understandable sensitivity when you start talking about group differences. And in part, it's because the topic feels racially charged. But the fact is that the actual facts debunk racial stereotypes if you go ahead and look at them. We show in our book that there are African-American groups and Hispanic groups that are among the most successful in the country, far outperforming the national average, outperforming the white average, debunking racial stereotypes. We show with respect to Asian Americans, this is one of the most interesting things that we found in all the research we did for this book. So I told you a second ago, Asian American kids are doing so well educationally, and that's not a stereotype, it's just a matter of fact. But when researchers looked at third generation Asian American kids, it turns out that their academic performance is no different from the rest of the country. Now think about that. It's extraordinary because it proves that it's not genetic, it's not biological, it's not racial. It's something going on in the first and second generations, in those families, in those cultures. And our thought was, we should have the confidence in ourselves and our institutions to pull back the curtain, try to look at those families and those cultures, and see what explained what was going on and why these groups were achieving disproportionate success. Now, here's an explanation that I bet is occurring to many of you, because it's the most comforting explanation. People say, you know, it's all about immigrant selectivity. These groups you're talking about, the immigrants come over with high skills and high levels of education. That's what explains the facts you've found. Well, those factors are important, for sure. But they are not nearly as important as people think. They just can't explain the phenomenon on the ground. It might be more comforting if they did, but they don't. I'll give you a couple of examples. First, they don't explain Mormon success. Mormons are not immigrants. Second, they don't explain Jewish American success. Most Jewish Americans in this country are no longer immigrants or the children of immigrants. They're mostly third, fourth, fifth generation. So there's no explanation there for that kind of success. By the way, the Mormons who are succeeding today, their parents, okay, I know you got Mitt Romney in mind, and you know about his parents, his dad was so wealthy, so successful. Most of them come from very humble origins. Parents of very modest, about 9 out of 10, modest means, not very well educated. But the most studied group are East Asian Americans. So the immigrant selectivity story doesn't even explain immigrant success. And I'll tell you about East Asian Americans. I'm talking about Chinese, Korean, Vietnamese Americans. Now, there are literally millions. So this population has been very well studied. And here's what they've found. It's it's called a bimodal community. That means half of them do come in on educational or employment visas. But half of them don't, actually, more than half don't. And this population that doesn't, they tend to be poor and poorly educated. High school education, sometimes barely literate. And yet their kids, so they've studied these populations, and their kids, the kids of the restaurant workers and the dry cleaners, first of all, they're performing just as well as the East Asian kids from the better parental backgrounds. That's interesting all by itself. That shows that the parental socioeconomic status is not doing the explanatory work. That's not what's doing it. They're all performing at this very high level, but the much more important fact is they're all outperforming the children of better educated, better off white parents. That's the phenomenon that so demands an explanation. See, our book is not, here's what's being said about our book. Here's how a lot of people are presenting it. Oh, you're saying that this immigrant group is better than this other group here. That's what you're saying. We're not saying anything of the sort. You don't need a book to write about why some immigrant group might do better than an inner city community that has been subject for 250 years to a history of discrimination, structural bias, denials of opportunity, exclusion. You wouldn't need to write a book about that. The phenomenon to be understood is, why are their kids, of these East Asian immigrants, and this is true of all the other immigrant groups too, why are they doing better than the kids of better educated, better off white parents? That's what we should be looking at, because that is something we can all, whatever color skin we are, however rich or poor we are, that's something we can all learn from. So that was our thought. That's why we wrote the book. And to explain to you what we found to be the explanation, here's Amy.
It's great to be back. Thank you all for coming. So picking up where Jed left off, we were happy to explain our methodology, but we came up with 8 groups that are sort of systematically most disproportionately successful, and we can explain to you how we selected those groups. But we decided to look at these disproportionately successful groups. And I want to stress, by the way, that this is really a snapshot in time. The book is called The Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups. And what we found very strikingly is that the groups that are successful today are not the same ones that were disproportionately successful 20 years ago. And 20 years from now, there will be different groups. But we looked at this snapshot and we said, you know, let's take a look at what do Nigerian Americans have in common with Persian Americans, with Mormons? And, you know, let's try to figure out what these groups are doing to get some of these astonishing results. And we actually, when we started, were not expecting to come up with one explanation. At first, we thought that the book was going to be about different cultural pathways to achievement. But to our surprise, as we dug in and really looked at these communities, we found a really striking pattern that just kind of kept hitting us over and over in the face. And that is that for all their enormous diversity, all of these extremely successful groups shared 3 qualities or cultural commonalities in common. And we call these the triple package. And the first, just to run through them, is a sense of exceptionality, of being special. And by the way, there are many different sources of this exceptionality. It doesn't have to come from belonging to a group or belonging to a family. A parent can instill their child with a sense of being special. I mean, there are just many different sources of that. The second quality that these groups share is interesting. It feels like almost the opposite. Added to the sense of exceptionality is a dash of insecurity. That is, this feeling that you're not quite good enough yet. You have to prove yourself. You haven't done enough yet. And the third element is impulse control. That is, self-discipline, the ability to resist temptation, and to persevere. And it's really the combination of these first two qualities that are at the crux of our thesis and that we find so fascinating. You know, I mean, it's paradoxical. How can somebody simultaneously feel insecure and superior? So to just give you one illustration, I guess a really extreme illustration, take Steve Jobs. He really is the paradigmatic case. If you read all of the biographies about him, he is almost always described as having a narcissistic personality, almost megalomaniac. He just always knew that he could change the world. At the same time, by all accounts, including his closest friends, they always described him as deeply insecure, having a chip on his shoulder almost. Some people speculate from being an orphan. But this chip on the shoulder that combined with the sense of being special to give him enormous drive. And of course, he's famous for his extreme discipline. Now, that is an extreme case. He was one of the most driven and disciplined people probably on the planet. But I use that example to highlight something important, and that is that Steve Jobs didn't belong to any one of the groups that we mentioned. And this is really important because our point is that anyone of any background, any ethnicity, can have these three qualities. In any given family, a parent, a strong grandparent, even just a strong mentor can instill children with all three of these qualities. In our book, we talk about the really interesting case of Sonia Sotomayor, who actually attributes her success in her life to her grandmother. So anyone of any background can have these three qualities, but our research shows that at this moment in time, some groups are instilling these qualities in their members, in their kids, in their families, more than the rest of the country, and these groups are disproportionately succeeding, at least by conventional metrics, which we'll get to in a second. And in our book, we explore the incredibly fascinating, totally different ways that these three qualities take in these different groups. They're very, very different. So, for example, the sense of exceptionality can be rooted in religion, as in the case of the Mormons, who have a very strong chosen people narrative, actually borrowed very much from the Jews. At the same time, Mormons also take enormous pride in their strong families and clean-cut values. In one historian's words, they see themselves as an island of morality in a sea of decay. So almost a sense of moral superiority. Iranian Americans, totally different source. They have a very strong sense of ethnic exceptionality. They are incredibly proud of their ancient civilization. They identify as Persians who speak Farsi as distinct from Arabs. Very similarly, Cuban Americans see themselves as distinct from other Hispanic Americans. And I highlight those last two cases because they really raise one of the great dangers of a superiority complex. This idea of enormous ethnic pride can all too quickly shade into ethnocentrism, intolerance, this feeling that we're better than other groups. And when Jed was describing this feeling of our book is really about kind of the erosion of success over generations too, kind of the creative destruction when these cultures interact with American individualism. But what you see is that first generation immigrant, I mean, not all our groups are immigrants, but in the immigrant cases, that ethnic pride, that ethnocentrism, the second generation, their children, often don't quite feel that. They are imbued with America's greatest value, equality. And they often don't speak the language anymore. And they're like, they reject their parents' exceptionality. They see it as intolerant and kind of rebel against that. And that's part of this dynamic. Finally, the sense of exceptionalism in the case of Asian Americans, part of it is actually not necessarily historical or anything kind of to do with the essential culture in an essentialist sense, but it comes, it's rooted in the sense of we are better at working hard, at we're better at excelling academically, and it becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, a sense of superiority alone is not a recipe for success. On the contrary, a sense of superiority, as you would expect, is much more likely to lead to complacency, to arrogance, to smugness. It's only when that sense of exceptionality is combined with insecurity that you get this interesting drive, this kind of goading sense that you need to prove yourself, that you need to show everybody, you need to gain respect. And it's interesting to note that all of the disproportionately successful groups we look at are outsiders in one way or another. So Mormons, by their own account, often feel they are not quite accepted by mainstream America. Many Christian denominations, or some, often see them as not quite Christian. Also, Mormons have a very keen historical memory of a history of persecution. Orrin Hatch would say that it's the only church in America that was subject to an extermination order. So again, this feeling of insecurity. More generally, just to be an immigrant of any background, not of the groups that we mentioned, just to be an immigrant in general is almost by definition to be insecure. You don't know. You're in a strange land. You may not speak the language. People look at you funny. You have accents. You don't. You're the person that doesn't know where anything is, doesn't quite fit in, kind of the consummate outsider. And at this point, I just wanted to add a personal note, because as Jed mentioned, the book has been characterized in the media as so differently from the way that we intended. Speaking for just myself, not for Jed, in some ways, this book is about how you turn being an outsider into a source of strength. And just a quick anecdote, I remember when I was in fourth grade, I was the only kid, Chinese kid, in my class, and there was a boy who just kept making fun of me. He made slanty eyes and was running around, making fun of my accent. I used to have a Chinese accent. And I felt bad about it, and I remember coming home and telling my mom about it. And my mother was annoyed at me. She said, I'll never forget, she said, why would you care? It's such a stupid person doing that. You know, if he's running around making fun of you, we come from the greatest, oldest, most ancient civilization and, you know, most scholarly. And if you can't, you know, if that person can't see that, why would you even waste your time thinking about him? And I remember, you know, that has shades of ethnocentrism. I mean, again, that's dangerous, this feeling that we're the most ancient civilization. But as an 8-year-old, that kind of sense of ethnic heritage gave me a kind of armor, a kind of armor against, I guess you could describe it as majority prejudice. And this phenomenon has been documented in studies, the way that certain minorities are able to turn the sense of adversity or being looked down on into an armor. And Jed and I actually intended for our book to be so much more broadly applicable. It's kind of been stuck in a debate that's been frustrating for us, because there are so many ways in which people all over the country feel that they're struggling, that they're a little bit of an outsider in different ways. So just to give you one illustration, we got an email, a very moving email from somebody who was disabled. He was an amputee. And he wrote us, I just love this book. Those three qualities that you describe resonate for me so much. They describe my life. And he said, as for me, as for so many other disabled people, it was this my disability and this incredible desire not to be pitied that gave me that drive, that made me feel like I'm going to work 20 times harder than anybody else to not be pitied, to show everyone. And again, he was a one-legged skier. And he said, when I skied past the two-legged skiers, I did feel superior. I did, because I had earned it. I had overcome. I had done more. And I think that is the kind of superiority, you know, based on your own just inner strength and resilience and determination. That's a kind of superiority that is honorable. I'll say more about, but that's something. So that was very interesting. And there are students of mine who have asked me, they're writing papers, does this model apply to women? Does it apply to gays? So anyway, that's the end of my aside about, so far I've been talking about insecurity, the second element of the triple package, but insecurity vis-a-vis one's place in society, the feeling of being an outsider or not quite accepted. I want to talk about a second form of insecurity that is equally important, maybe more provocative and startling, and that is insecurity created inside the family. Basically, parents making their children feel that they are not good enough yet. And this idea, the idea of deliberately making a child feel this way, is practically anathema to mainstream thinking. It's the exact opposite of the goals of the self-esteem movement. And yet, in very different ways, every one of the groups that we look at instill this sense in their children in very different ways. So just as one example, in Asian American immigrant families, parents famously impose exorbitantly high academic expectations. And this is not a stereotype. It's corroborated by just hundreds of studies. So this is the proverbial, why just a 99? Why not 100? That is not good enough yet. Studies also show that East Asian parents, this is Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Vietnamese, these parents are much more likely to make pointed comparisons to other successful kids. So I heard that so-and-so's kid just got into Princeton. You know, oh, so your cousin just got elected valedictorian. Again, instilling this feeling of everyone else is doing better. You need to work harder. Finally, to further pile on, academic success in these cases is often tied to family honor. This feeling of if you don't do well, you're going to disgrace the whole family. I mean, talk about pressure. And in some of the studies we look at, by the way, about Jews on the Lower East Side in the 1900s and 1910s, you would not believe it. It sounds exactly like this. I mean, people forget now, but it was the same kind of thing. Has to be A's. You know, you've got to be, you know, the same kind of the same kind of pressures. But by the way, this is not just Asian Americans. In a study of over 5,000 immigrant children from all backgrounds, all continents, the finding was that the children uniformly, repeatedly said that they all felt an acute anxiety that if they didn't succeed academically, they would be failing their parents and wasting all the sacrifices that their parents had made for them. Again, this mentality is the exact opposite of what parents focused on self-esteem is trying to cultivate. And as Jed and I wrote a little bit provocatively in our New York Times op-ed from last month, there's an ocean of difference between this parental message, you're amazing, mommy and daddy never want you to worry about a thing. There's an ocean of difference between that message and this parental message. If you don't do well at school, you'll be letting down the whole family and end up a bum on the streets. Very harsh, but can light a fire. The third, for us in some ways most important or equally important, element of the triple package is impulse control. And for lack of time, I won't say much. I will just say that it was so interesting. You know, we didn't know anything about the Mormon community, but when we looked at the way these different cultures raise their kids, you see that in all the cultures we look at that are so disproportionately successful, there is a strict emphasis on much more discipline and focused activities in children at a very early age, very early. There's an interesting study about Chinese immigrant parents. They force their preschool children, this is age three or four, to engage on average in about one hour a day on a focused activity. And that is defined as anything where you're just sitting down, drawing, you know, reading, doing a puzzle, but 1 hour as opposed to 6 minutes a day for the mainstream Western parents. Similarly, in Mormon households, children are taught very, very early to tithe to save money, put it away for the church, fasting practices, sitting still for hours at church services. So this is another thing that unites all these very different groups. So those, in a nutshell, are the three elements of the triple package that we say, in combination, not in isolation, but in combination, produce both a longing to rise, using Tocqueville's terms, and the ability to rise. Now, before I turn this back over to Jed to conclude, and we're eager to hear your questions, I just wanted to say that we deliberately chose, we thought very carefully about what terms to choose for our book. We could have written a much more happy sugarcoating book about success. You know, all it takes is confidence and grit and big dreams. Instead, we purposely chose terms that are very loaded and ambivalent. That is, insecurity. That's definitely not a positive term. A superiority complex. Impulse control. And the reason for that is because we didn't intend for this book to be a celebration, a simplistic celebration of material success or the triple package. On the contrary, as we say, actually on the first page of our book, we wanted to offer an honest, a new way of looking at success, including its hidden spurs, its inner dynamics, and its psychological costs. And we spend, I would say, maybe half the book actually looking at the underside of the triple package. We explore the pathologies of each of these elements. And kind of to jump ahead, this feeling that you haven't done enough yet, that you have to prove yourself, whether to society or to your parents or to your family or your community, that feeling can be very unpleasant. It can be very unpleasant. It's so interesting. Vera Wang, the fashion designer who designed wedding dresses for Chelsea Clinton and Kim Kardashian, one of my own idols, in her interviews, she describes just this phenomenon. Her father never approved of her career choice, what everybody else, you know, so many people want to be. And she writes that, you know, I just never felt good enough, and I always now, even now, can only see what I don't do well enough, not what I've done well. Taken to extremes, it can really be painful. Amy Tan has written, I grew up thinking that I would never, ever please my parents. It's a horrible feeling. There are moments where I would just wanted to die. Now, that's an extreme case. Of course, not everybody feels that way. And I do want to stress on the other side that the opposite of feeling that you need to prove yourself is being entitled. That's the exact opposite. If you're entitled, you precisely feel you don't need to earn anything. You're entitled to the job. You're entitled to respect. You're entitled to whatever you want. And that's not great either. So, you know, the studies have shown that, that pretty much there's nothing good about being entitled. Extremely entitled people are often selfish. They are less able to enter into good, strong relationships, and they are often less happy. For example, when they don't get the job that they feel entitled to. So that's the kind of thing that we intended to erase in our book. Is there some way to get a balance, you know, between, on the one hand, this feeling that you're never good enough that can make some people feel so much like they're in a prison of expectations, and on the other hand, this feeling of entitlement that I don't need to do anything, that I don't need to earn anybody's respect or anything. Finally, the last thing I'll say is, Jed is going to talk more about this, but one critique that we've had is you only focus on material success. Actually, in our book, it's exactly the opposite, and I'm just going to touch on one part of it. One of the things that we focus on is because of the nature of the kind of insecurity that drives this motivation, the insecurity of, I need to show everybody, I need to prove to society, I need to show my parents, that kind of insecurity tends to force people into very narrow, conventional, kind of prestige-oriented forms of careers. Because how else are you going to show everybody? You know, you have to be a doctor or a lawyer, something that has a badge of merit that people can recognize. And we actually treat this as a pathology of the triple package, far from saying that it's a good thing. And what we talk about is how that's often in the first generation, but then the second generation, the children growing up in these households, don't like that. They don't want to be what their parents want them to be. I'll conclude with one really interesting anecdote. Ong Lee, raised exactly in this kind of a household, he writes about how he never could quite please his father. But amazing story, after he won the Academy Award for Best Director, what we all dream of, that, you know, for Brokeback Mountain, so revolutionary. His father apparently said to him, now that you've done that, you know, maybe you can be an academic now. I'll turn this over to Jed.
Well, that story that Amy just told at the end reminds me of a story I just got to tell you. It's an old Jewish joke. So there's this Jewish daughter, and she gets elected president of the United States. So she calls her mom and says, Mom, you're going to come to the inauguration, right? And mom says, oh, do I have to? It's so much trouble. And the daughter says, Mom, of course you got to come to the inauguration. And the mom says, okay, I'll come. So she goes to the inauguration ceremony, and there's her daughter being inaugurated, and she tugs on the sleeve of the man sitting next to her, and she says, you see that girl being inaugurated president? And the guy says, yeah, of course I see her. She says, her brother is a doctor. So, you know, like, you got to be president, but you could have been a doctor. I'm sure she's telling the son, you know, you're a doctor, but look at your sister. So it doesn't all have to be like Asian tiger parenting. I mean, it's not really a parenting book, but there are many ways that parents can instill this, like, double, you know, exceptionality, insecurity thing into people. We want to take your questions, but I thought I would ask a couple of questions of us on your behalf so we could answer. First of all, you might want to ask us, how can you ignore the unbalanced, the uneven playing field? How can you ignore the social problems we have, the structural problems? How can you not pay attention to that when you're talking about group differences? We don't ignore that. What's our view of the causes of entrenched poverty in the United States? Well, I was mentioning them before. A history of discrimination and exclusion, denials of opportunity, macroeconomic changes that have wiped out whole economic sectors that have nothing to do with culture. But the thing is, you got to avoid the false dichotomy. So there are many people on the right who want to say, the American meritocracy is perfect. The playing field is level. Every individual outcome is solely a basis of individual decision and merit and choices. And there are people on the left who say, no, it's all about structure. It's all about social problems. It's all about bias. We've got to fix the playing field. We've got to have institutional change. We've got to get rid of discrimination, which we do have to do. We need all of that to change. America's got to change to make the playing field more level, but we also have to be able to see and to say at the same time, there are a set of behaviors that some people are engaging in, and in some groups more than others, that's helping them and their kids succeed. How can we not realize that it's both? And if we don't say that, if what we say to America's poorer communities is it's all structural, you better just wait for the institutions to change, for discrimination to end. You better just wait 100 years. Is that giving them any agency? Is that saying, oh, there's nothing you can do in your own life? Is that the message that you want to convey? Is that truthful? Is that respectful? Isn't that the ultimate disparagement, to say that people have no agency, no control, no power at all over their own lives? I want to ask one other question of us and then try to answer it. And the question is, how can you define success as material wealth? How can you do that? You think success is just material success? No, we don't think so. We don't define it that way. We observe that some groups are doing better in terms of material success and educational success than others. To observe that fact isn't to define success that way. It's just to observe a fact about the world. What are we going to do? Hide our heads in the sand and pretend that fact doesn't exist? Now, if people aren't interested in material success, they don't have to read our book. Maybe it's of no relevance to them. But if you're interested in our society's anti-poverty programs, if you're interested in what we should do with our education dollars, if you're interested in trying to combat inequality, then you do want to know how that's happening, why it is that in some groups kids are experiencing exceptional upward mobility in the conventional narrow form of success that we're looking at, that we focus on for the first half of our book. Now, by the way, I do want to say, though, that in the last couple of chapters of our book, we break away from that because we really think, at the end of the day, that just as our book is about individuals and not about groups, it's about success of all different kinds. We think that these qualities, these behaviors, these traits that we've identified can empower people to achieve success of very different kinds. Amy was already talking about this. It's one of the glories of America that the second generation, often in these groups, turns around, look at their parents and says, you know, we don't quite buy that superiority story you're telling us about our ethnic group. That's a great thing. They also turn around and say, we don't buy the kind of success that you expect us to have. We don't want to be a doctor or whatever it is. We want to be an artist or a singer. And these same qualities can help people achieve that too, including the kinds of success that aren't measured by personal gain at all, but are measured by service to your community or your family. I mean, there's so many things to talk about here. We could talk about success, happiness, meaning, a meaningful life. All those three things are not the same. And anybody who thought that material success meant you'd be happy or have a meaningful life, that obviously would be a colossal mistake. And we don't think that. What we do think is that there's something going on here with how culture orients people in time. Here's what I mean by that. Here's one of the things that cultures do. So some cultures, they encourage people to venerate the past, to live for the past. Those are traditionalist cultures. Then there are other cultures that encourage their members to live toward the future for some reason or of some kind. Then there are other cultures that encourage their members to live for the moment. And yeah, I think that America has moved a little bit in that direction in the last 25, 30 years. A little bit too much instant gratification, just live for the now. What these triple package groups are really good at doing is getting their members to live for the future in a certain kind of way. And the great thing, the aspirational thing, is if you can do that, but do it when you yourself choose the goals and write the script that you're living for. Because then you've chosen your goal, you can work toward it, you can get up off the ground the first 12 times you get knocked down. That's part of the perseverance. And with that thought, I'm going to read one sentence, just one sentence from our book, and close with it, and then we'll take your questions. Here's a sentence. It's from the last page of the book. The triple package doesn't promise a meaningful life, but it makes such a life possible because it allows people to seize the reins of time, to live not only in the present, but also for the future, to devote their full capacities to changing themselves or the world in small ways or large. Thanks, and we'll take your questions now.
They really like it, and it's the message that we need. Can you comment on that, or has there been a group that you've gotten a lot of positive feedback from?
Wait, are you saying that or not? He didn't say whether he was saying it.
I love it. I love the book. Okay. I mean, I haven't read it, but I love the ideas behind it.
You wouldn't know it, but actually we have had incredibly positive feedback from people who have read the book. And just to give you one big group, educators. Almost uniform. In fact, we've been asked but to join forces with all kinds of major organizations. Maybe I'll just take this opportunity to just share one email. I got this email from a public high school teacher in Southern California, and he said, I'm Latino, and I'm a public high school teacher, and I also am a father. And he said, I just can't believe what I'm reading, this controversy. I look in my classroom every day, and I think about culture and success all the time. I see these Asian immigrant kids. Immediately that suggests, are you stereotyping? But he just says, and I see that they have different study habits and different expectations on them, and that that is leading to better academic performance. And he said, so I told my own son, copy everything they're doing. We are going to do that. We're going to have this. And now my son is a straight-A student. And that's the kind of thing, you know, it's the behaviors. There's nothing, we're not using culture in the sense that it's something only people of the Confucian tradition can do. These are behaviors that, we're not trying to make it easy. Some people have much steeper hills to climb. But at some level, they are accessible. Thank you.
Can I just just add one thing to that? So what did Amy just say? She said, Asian American kids are achieving better educational results in part because their study habits are different. They're working harder and their parents are putting different demands on them. Now, apparently when you say that in America today, you get accused of cultural racism. Now think about that. I mean, we wrote the book hoping to start a conversation, and it just feels to us like it's got to be possible to say that. Why are Asian American kids doing better? Because they're working harder. That's why. In significant part. Once you've disproved the genetic part, which we have, and disproved the immigrant selectivity, and aren't we at a point where we can be honest enough and confident in our country and in ourselves enough to be able to say that? That's the kind of conversation we wanted to have, and a lot of people don't want to have that conversation, I think.
Really interesting and excellent presentation. Thank you. So, if I look at this a little from the scientific point of view, what you've shown is a correlation. I haven't read the book, so maybe you've shown more, but you've essentially talked about a correlation. You look at these groups, and you see when they're successful, they have this triple package. But that doesn't mean there's a cause and effect involved. And so my question is, have you looked at controls for this? Have you looked at Jewish families that don't have the triple package? Do their children succeed just as well? Or do they succeed less well? Or Chinese families? There must be some who don't have that and don't instill those qualities.
That's a great question. Now, you know that, I'm sure you know this, but it's a feature of all statistical analysis, and our book is very data-driven and statistic-driven. It's a feature of all statistical analysis that it can only show correlation, not causation. So the best statistical studies only ever show correlation. And then you need some checks. So you do your checks of the kind you're talking about. And yes, one of the poorest cities in the entire United States, in fact, the poorest with a population of over 10,000, is Kiryas Yoel, which is about 50 miles north of New York City. Its population, Satmar Orthodox Jews. And why are they poor? Well, this is a long conversation, but the essential thing is they do not have insecurity of the kind that we're talking about. They're similar to the Amish in this way. They have learned to find security in their faith and their traditions. They don't care what the rest of the world thinks of them. They don't care. They don't have this striving where you've got to achieve something in order to prove yourself, because they're not interested in proving themselves in that way. A lot of fundamentalist communities have found security in their faith. They've turned away from, they don't care what America thinks of them. There are fundamentalist Mormons, communities of 10,000 or more in Colorado and in Utah, incredibly poor. And we say for the same reasons. But I do want to say our theory in terms of causality, it has way more explanatory power. It can explain, for example, this, and it's just one example of many. There's this phenomenon that group success in the United States tends to last two generations. American Jews are an exception to this, and we think they fit our theory too. But in general, you get second generation extraordinary success and then third generation dissipation. This is the general rule, happens over and over and over. Sociologists have shown this. Immigrant selectivity can't explain it. Genetic accounts can't explain it. Bias in society can't explain it. We know of no theory that can explain it, but ours explains it perfectly, because it's the culture and the drive that's transmitted from the first to the second generation, and then success begins to erode the foundations of that. People get less insecure, they get better off, they have less reason to exercise impulse control. So there's tons of causal explanatory power, we think, in our theory.
Actually, in the Jews are an interesting case, and I think I don't know that any of other theories out there can account for Jewish success that has persisted. Again, they are not an immigrant population anymore. They are now fourth, fifth generation. So you can't say immigrant selectivity. Now, of course, a lot of people think there's genetic, and we talk about those studies, and it seems to be that they are inconclusive. If they were true, that could feed into the sense of superiority, but we don't take that view. Our model actually is just very, I think, powerful on this one, because the Jews are different in one sense. Even, you know, so they were second generation immigrants by, let's say, the, you know, 1940s, 1950s. And then what happened? The Holocaust. So there's this history of persecution, and also the memory of it's like ongoing insecurity in some ways. And of course Israel, which many American Jews identify. So maybe I'll just take more questions and we can say more later.
The basis of what you've been saying tonight is that the success is family driven. Am I correct in that interpretation? So conversely, those groups that are not succeeding do not have strong family, do not have perhaps strong faith, do not have strong morality. A lot of, you know, the opposite of what makes someone successful. So how do you help people that don't have the basics get the basics to then pull themselves and their next generations up into that better atmosphere?
You know, I agree with much of what you're saying. Let's not fall into the false dichotomy, though. A lot of people face an insuperable climb in the United States, and they grow up in a situation where all the odds are stacked against them. And they have schools that don't teach, and there's mass incarceration, and there are no jobs. So it would be wrong to say that, to blame poverty on culture. We don't do that. You can't do that. I do think you got to be willing to look at both sides and see that both things are going on. So as to your question, well, yeah, we think that our theory supports those who have shown and are calling for the spending of our education dollars much more on very early programs. So there's an economist named James Heckman, Nobel Prize winner. He's shown through, you know, very systematic empirical research that when you just throw laptops at kids, or in some cases just try to make college tuition cheaper, which is a great thing, it doesn't nearly pay off as well as when you get in there, these early intervention programs, when kids are just 3 or 4, and you work with the families too, and you try to teach a different outlook toward education. You try to teach motivation and perseverance and wanting to succeed at school and early reading habits. And they found that this is the most successful thing we're doing. And that's consistent with our theory. I do just want to say one last thing about what Amy was talking about a second ago. And I'm not really adding anything, but I saw this in my own father, I think. My grandfather was an immigrant. And this is a long time ago. He came over in 1904. And so my father was born in 1929. And, he's second generation. And, he's doing pretty well. And at the time when he should have been feeling more comfortable and starting to lose that insecurity, he was about 13, 14. That's when he lived through World War II. And I saw it his whole life before he passed away, that, you know, that stuck with him, that kind of sense of anxiety and insecurity. And so I do think it's an interesting part of what accounts for the persistence of Jewish success over the generations, over centuries. No group, it seems, has this chosen people narrative, but also this deep sense of insecurity and peril and fear so built into it, these two qualities so built into its whole history, maybe, as the Jewish people.
I also, going back to your question about families, I think maybe for me the most interesting study in our book is what I'll call the reverse marshmallow test. So you probably all know about the famous original marshmallow test. This is in Stanford in the 70s. Somebody, Walter Mischel, offered kids, you could either take one marshmallow now or wait 15 minutes and you will get two marshmallows. And what they found is that the kids who waited the extra 15 minutes, who were able to defer gratification, years later, 30 years later, turned out to be wildly more successful in terms of health and income and education and just even family stability. Well, they recently ran the marshmallow test with an amazing twist. This is at the University of Rochester. This time, they took half the kids and they lied to them. So they first said, if you do X and Y, we will give you these cool art supplies. And then they broke their promise. They never delivered on the art supplies. And then they ran the old marshmallow test. Do you want one marshmallow now or 15 minutes later? Every one of the children who had been lied to grabbed the first marshmallow. And that makes perfect sense. That's rational behavior. But the point of this is that if you come from a group or if you're just you as an individual, don't believe in your institutions. If you don't trust them, if they have failed you, so that you don't believe that if you work hard and wait and do, you know, then why would you invest? Why would you have the incentive to have deferred gratification? So the point of this is, you know, our institutions have to do some of the work too. And I, in some of these educating, these groups that we're looking at, they're actually talking about this. They're like, in classrooms, you have this interesting phenomenon where immigrants, often because they've come from much more terrible places, you know, much more poverty, much more corruption, violence. So whether rightly or not, they come to this country and they believe in our institutions. They believe in the promise of America. And for justifiable reasons, others who have been here longer don't. And how a teacher can kind of deal with that, you know, people with very different perspectives. So more questions, please?
I suspect that a majority of students would react positively to the kind of structure and pressure that you appear to be talking about. But I also suspect that there's a minority of students, perhaps a significant minority, who would respond better to a lighter touch and for whom your approach might be counterproductive. And I wonder if you would address that.
Well, that's an important question. It allows us to clarify. This is not, again, I want to stress, this is not a how-to guide. We've kind of learned that no matter what you write, people just want to see things as a how-to guide. I had this with Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, my book, which was sort of like a funny memoir. And in the end, my daughter rebels and my sister gets cancer. And it's kind of a reflection. And everyone is like, so, you know, should we play the piano or the violin? Yeah. And so in this book, again, Katie Royfe in the Financial Times, I really liked her review. She got it. She said it's a meditation on success, you know, including, again, its cost. So I think it's not right that this is our approach. That's not what we mean. We do mean to lay it out and say, look, it's so interesting. If you care, these groups that happen to be doing so well right now, for those who do care, what are they doing? And to lay it out there, and some of these things I think are things that we could all benefit from. So I agree. I probably think right now with all the distractions in our high-tech life that a little bit of more focus in young children is probably a good thing that we could all, I mean, I'm constantly distracted by email and my things myself. But when I described earlier what you're calling the less light touch, you know, I'm quite serious that that has a cost and that it may not only, it's not just not right for certain groups, it may not be right for certain individuals, certain parents. I mean, every family is different, every child is different. So I think that's an important clarification.
It seems that these days the politically correct thing is everybody is the same and not to bring up differences in people, which there are. And I just can't see that. It seems like in order to try to learn from some of these things that you've come up with, there would have to be more recognition among our leaders of differences between groups and that sort of thing.
You know, it's so interesting. Thank you. we think that there's also maybe there's something of a message here for America too. It's our, what we found, and maybe this is kind of a metaphor because America's a country, not an ethnic group or anything. The values we're talking about, these triple package values, they seem to us, or seem to me at least, to be traditional American values. America was born with the same triple package set of traits. A strong sense of exceptionality. Everybody knows about that. You know, American exceptionalism. A sense of insecurity vis-a-vis more aristocratic Europe. So Thomas Jefferson once sent a giant moose carcass to Paris to prove that America's animals were bigger than Europe's. And also another kind of insecurity, too. The insecurity of something new in the world, a capitalist system, a freewheeling capitalist system, which creates in individuals, for the first time maybe in history, everybody's judged a success or failure depending on whether they make it or not. That's a whole different kind of society. That's what Tocqueville was writing about when he said Americans have this longing to rise. And also this inheritance of the Puritan ethic, hard work, restraint, impulse control. Now, something we think has changed in the last 30, 40 years, and we could talk about what it is. It's hard to know what it is. Maybe it's a lot of things. But after the end of the Cold War, or perhaps because of the prosperity of the 80s and 90s, America seems to have begun or began to lose some of its insecurity, maybe got a little bit too secure. And impulse control? Well, you know, the whole immediate gratification society, I think Americans could use a lot more impulse control. By about the year 2000, what we had left was the superiority complex, which by itself is a recipe for swagger and belligerence and complacency. And if you take away those other two tempering qualities, not a good formula. And the strange thing is, you know, maybe paradoxically or perversely, some of the adversity that we've gone through in the last decade, which has been really bad, maybe has a silver lining. Maybe it's returned to us some of that insecurity, rise of China, unwon wars, financial collapse. I mean, you know, how did, I don't want to go on about this, but like the national debt, that is, do you know until 1980, our national debt was the same level in terms of GDP as it was in 1790? And then since 1980, now it's over 100% of GDP. The fascinating thing, see, it takes restraint, self-restraint, not to borrow. Why not borrow all this money and put all the debt on the shoulders of the next generations? Why not do what we want to do now and let them pay the cost? The fascinating thing is, how did we have that culture of restraint and impulse control in our politics before 1980? But however we had it, we began to lose it. And now, and you see this at the top of corporate America too, you know, get the billion-dollar gain right now, and who cares about the consequences? We'll let the rest of the country deal with that. So we need to get rid of this short-termism in America. Amy and I think that if we can get back to some of these, what we're calling triple package values, it might help us to get back to where we were.
I just wanted to say one thing, because you were asking about equality, you know, in different views. And Jed was talking in our last chapter, you know, we it's kind of a thought experiment. We talk about America. But at the end, you know, we ask this question, is it even right to say America should be getting back its triple package? Well, a lot of that depends on its content. And this is what we say. Most importantly, the superiority complex. As I mentioned in my remarks, we chose that term purposely because knowing how dangerous it is. You know, in history, superiority complexes taken to an extreme have been responsible for maybe the worst atrocities in human history. Apartheid, slavery, genocide. That's rooted in a superiority complex. So what we say at the end is, when you're talking about America's superiority complex, well, there have been different strands of this throughout history. For many years, it was a little bit in practice, almost like a white superiority. I mean, there are many, you know, not so good sides. But what we say is that sort of aspirationally, there was always from the beginning, at least in principle, a superiority based on equality and tolerance, the superiority based on opportunity, and that would actually be a superiority complex worth aspiring to. And we talk, not time to play this out now, how the national superiority complex, this norm of equality kind of interacts with the superiority complexes of these new groups, you know, because the groups can have that. And then group complexes kind of erode and weaken, and this is part of this process of creative destruction that we think is actually part of the dynamism and the magic of America. A few more, okay.
Do we have time for one more, or is that one more question?
I love your points about the friction between exceptionalism and you're not good enough. That works well in creating drive. I hear faith, family, education. They're kind of themes here that a lot of achievers seem to have components of. And I look at the eight groups that you study. I haven't read the book, read the article in the paper today. Will read the book. And it's ironic, in the shadow of the cathedral next door to the new Mormon temple and apartment building going on, that when I think of faith, family, and education, I think of Catholics who've educated probably hundreds of millions of people in this country. That might be a high number, but in the Northeast United States particularly. And through their own money, through elementary school, high school, and the university speak for themselves, by which, you know, many Asians and Jewish people and people of all faiths attend places like Georgetown University, etc. So I think I'm curious. I'm sure you studied more than just your eight groups and selected the eight groups for good reasons. But I'm curious how you reflect on the Catholics. And I'll close by saying that a billionaire banker I know from New Jersey once said, "Give me a crew of people educated in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, and I'll take them over a Wharton person anytime." So anyway, just a kind of a broad topic. I'm wondering if you...
Yeah, great question. And actually, this is kind of the kind of conversation that we were hoping to have. I was raised Catholic, and so little pieces of this answer. First, since Weber wrote, actually many of the most successful groups in America are Catholic. There are lots of these immigrant groups, actually, who are very successful, who are Catholic. So it's kind of all over the place. We actually talk a lot about the relationship between the Triple Package and Christianity. It's really, really interesting. And I don't have all the answers, but I'll just say that we've certainly done some research and talked to students. Catholicism, like the Amish, actually, there's an enormous sense, an emphasis on humility. You know, the last shall come first, the meek shall inherit the earth. And it's interesting to we've talked about whether there's something the superiority of humility and not trying to have too much material wealth, and how that plays out. And do you want to say something about the Amish? Or no. So we have quite a section on Max Weber and how, you know, in some ways we actually think that his book, when he was talking about the Calvinists, it was exactly the Triple Package. Because think about it, his group, they were this idea of the elect. You know, that is the ultimate exceptionalism. And then because you could never know under their theology that you were one of the elect, you know, there was this constant insecurity, and the way you proved it was by actually being successful in a worldly material way. And then you had massive impulse control. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, yeah.
No. I was just going to say two things. The reason why Amy is bringing up Weber's famous book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, is because that book begins, written 100 years ago, by observing that at that time, Protestants all over the Western world were outperforming Catholics economically. That's page one of his book. And he says, how could that be? Why is that? And he wrote a whole book to try to explain it. Now, in 100 years since, the economics of that have shifted, so and maybe the cultures have shifted, so it's not the same anymore. The last thing I wanted to say was, you mentioned an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer. How many people saw, like, the headline and said, okay, now if you read that article, so it's still going on, you will see the following sentence. The author that article. I'm very pleased that he wrote that. It's very nice of him, and I thank him for it. But he writes the following. He says, Chu and Rubenfeld focus on eight groups that they're saying are outperforming the national average. And then comes the following sentence. Everyone else, that's in quotes, everyone else, the authors glibly write, is contributing to the downfall of America, end quote. We did not say that, okay? Now, I mean, we never said that. We never said anything like that. He is quoting from the first horrible, crazy review of our book that came out in the New York Post that, like, said all this crazy stuff about it. I don't even think that author, that reviewer had read it. So he's quoting that author and then saying that we wrote it. Now, this has been happening to us for the last 4 weeks over and over, and I just wanted to say this because if you read that, please know we never said anything like that. We don't believe that. We never would say anything like that. So I've begged them to publish a correction. I don't know if they will.
But it's been such an honor and such a pleasure to be in this open discussion. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.